This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The UK approves a coronavirus vaccine. Relief, as the Prime Minister is urging patients.
It is very, very important that people do not get their hopes up too soon.
The vaccine rollout will take time, and testing will remain critical for months to come. But for clinics and for home, there's also progress on that front.
The possibility for cheap tests that can be used at point of care or even at home is there.
Also today, a Hollywood star comes out as transgender. For a marginalized group, star power makes a difference.
When it's a celebrity, there is a sense in most people that they do know that person. It makes trans people seem more real.
And there's a pathway to empathy and understanding. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us this Wednesday. Here's some news we've been waiting months to hear. A vaccine for the coronavirus is coming. In just a few days' time, people in Britain will be receiving the first doses. Today, the UK became the first country worldwide to approve the new vaccine from Pfizer. It is the fastest rollout ever from concept to inoculation. Prime Minister Boris Johnson called it a huge and moving moment for Britain. This put more pressure on the FDA here in the US and regulators around the world to grant approval for other vaccines. The World's Orla Barry joins us from London. Orla, explain how the UK plans to start rolling out the vaccine next week.
Well, the plan, Marco, is 800,000 doses of the vaccine will be available from next week. But don't forget, you need two jabs 3 weeks apart. So in other words, that's 400,000 people who'll be vaccinated by the end of December. And the plan, we were told today, is to start by vaccinating those seen as most vulnerable to the virus. In other words, those who are most likely to die from the coronavirus. And the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation here said this morning, they'll start by offering the vaccine to residents of care homes and their carers. Then it'll be to those who are 80 years of age and over, and then frontline healthcare workers, and then working down through the age groups 75, 70, and they'll start vaccinating those with serious underlying conditions over the age of 16 at that stage. And they'll keep on working down through the ages until they reach those over 50, and that's all part of what they've described as phase one. But one thing to say, the scientific advisors this morning were also saying, look, these are recommendations, but local healthcare providers must consider if they need to be more flexible in how they prioritise who gets the vaccine. And maybe they'll have to take into account ethnicity, for example, or those who may be deprived of adequate healthcare. And that might sort of change the goalposts a little bit.
And the actual deployment of the vaccines, where will that happen?
Yeah, good question, because this vaccine, as you know, has to be kept generally in freezing temperatures of about minus 70 degrees Celsius, which is minus 94 Fahrenheit. So it's hospitals in the main that have those facilities already in place to store the vaccine. It's very likely that the first vaccinations that we're going to see, even if it's with residents in care homes, they may have to travel to hospitals to get vaccinated. It is a huge logistics issue. What they've done is they're dividing it between hospitals, between vaccination centres, and then in the community with GPs and pharmacists, etc. So these vaccination centres, they're places like conference centres and sports stadiums. They're all being set up at the moment. And the NHS, the National Health Service here, came out in the last couple of weeks, and they've been appealing for volunteers to help them administer the vaccine over the next few weeks.
What kind of reaction have you been hearing today?
Generally enormous relief, as you can imagine. It is the news we've all waited for. Also, I should say, it's the end of lockdown today. National lockdown ended this morning. So some areas, at the very least, have gone back to some semblance of normality. But I spoke to Ruth Isden with Age Action UK about this earlier. It's a British charity that represents older people.
It's hard to overstate how horrible this year has been for many older people and their families. And we've seen older people become isolated and lonely at home. We've seen families separate. collaborative. It's been heartbreaking. So the news that a vaccine that is effective in older people is potentially on its way now is going to be a real ray of light at the end of the tunnel.
But what was interesting, Marco, to see, and as you said, Boris Johnson described this as a very moving moment for Britain. But when he was talking in Parliament about it this afternoon, he sounded a much more cautious tone than I expected.
I think at this stage, it is very, very important that people do not get their hopes up too soon about the speed with which we will be able to roll out this vaccine. It is beginning, as my right hon. Friend the Health Secretary has said, from next week. But that's why I put so much emphasis, Mr. Speaker, on the continuing importance of the tiering system of mass community testing at the same time as we go forward through these tough winter months.
And although many people are, you know, very happy at the news today, I should say social media here is still full of messages of concern from people worried about the vaccine. And actually a YouGov poll out this evening in Britain, the polling agency in Britain, said 20% of people here have little confidence in the safety of the vaccine.
Right. I mean, there are still a sizable number of people who have concerns about getting vaccinated. Did the British regulator address any of those concerns today?
She did, actually. Dr. June Raine is the head of the UK's regulatory body, the MHRA, here, and she gave a long televised press conference this morning. And there was one issue she mentioned over and over and over, and that was the question of safety.
This vaccine, produced and developed by Pfizer-BioNTech, meets rigorous high standards of safety, of effectiveness and of quality. The public's safety has always been at the forefront of our minds. Safety is our watchword, and it will always continue to be so.
We've not cut any corners. That was another phrase she used repeatedly during the press conference. What is interesting is to see this afternoon, the regulatory body in Europe, which is the European Medicines Agency, said they will decide before December 29th whether they will grant approval to the Pfizer vaccine. So that'll be at least 4 weeks after Britain.
The world's Orla Barry there in London with what generally seems to be a good news milestone in the pandemic. Orla, thanks very much for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
The rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine is likely to be a story of haves and have-nots. Wealthy nations have pre-ordered millions of vaccines to inoculate their entire populations as soon as possible. For poorer countries, the rollout may take longer, perhaps years in some cases. Dr. Michelle Geyer has looked at how low-income countries might address those disparities. She directs emergency health at the International Rescue Committee and has worked with the WHO to oversee vaccine rollouts. Dr. Geyer, there are so many barriers facing low-income countries. Let's start out with just cost and availability. Will COVID vaccines be affordable for low-resource countries? And if so, will they be able to get their hands on them?
What we worry about is that poorer countries, well, they just won't be able to afford it. You know, even $3 a dose is very expensive if you've got many other vaccines to roll out. You've got to remember that COVID isn't the only disease that's affecting populations in low-resource countries. You know, they've got to get out measles vaccine, diphtheria, polio, pertussis, all these other things, which are, you know, lifesavers as well. And so we're really asking them to be second tier or third tier. There has been a global initiative set up called the COVAX facility for pooled procurement and the equitable distribution of a COVID vaccine to poorer countries. Now, this initiative is led by WHO, Gavi, which is the Vaccine Alliance, and the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. And this allows everyone to sign up. Every country can sign up, whether you're wealthy or a less developed country, to ensure access. But this is for only up to 20% of your population. What we worry about is that 20% is obviously not enough. And countries that go into bilateral agreements, as many countries have done, basically, you know, keep prices high or push prices up.
So what worries you most about the rollout? Is it a question of cost and availability, or does it have more to do with infrastructure for transport, storage and distribution?
It's multiple, actually. So first of all, it's availability. We have to get vaccines to countries at a very, very large scale. So we're talking, if we want everyone in the world to be vaccinated, we're talking something like 14 billion vaccines. And the production capacity is something around 2 to 4 billion by the end of 2021. So we're already at a massive shortage there. Then there is actually what we call national equity. So how do you allocate the vaccines once they arrive in your country. Now, of course, many countries have started to figure that out, who's the high risk, etc. However, we have to think about all the sort of marginalized populations that may not be in national plans. We work in very, very difficult countries where there's conflict, disaster, and we have basically seen that, you know, 40% of children, for example, never receive even a single dose of any vaccine because they're so hard to reach. In a country like Yemen, nearly 20 million people live in these difficult areas. That's a third of, for example, the UK population, right? So how, for us, national equity is really important, making sure that people are included on lists. Then, of course, as you mentioned, it is the logistics and rollout. And that is absolutely a nightmare situation because we've talked about vaccination for many diseases. Generally, they require mass distribution, for example, for a certain group of people. So we've got a lot of experience in doing mass campaigns for measles, right? And that's for under five children. Here, we're talking about everyone. And so that's a scale that we haven't really ever done. The other logistical issue is really the sort of planning. So two doses, 21 to 28 days apart, depending on which vaccine is being used. So people, do they come to you? Do you go to them? How do you manage to keep the vaccine at a temperature if you're going outreach, if you're going to small clinics? Do they have fridges? If those fridges don't have electricity, you know, is there gas? If the power drops out, you know, will that all of those vaccines be wasted? There's a lot of you know, logistical issues that have to be considered. And then you have to ask them to come back again because it's a two-dose vaccine. So just those logistical issues are actually already difficult in developed countries, let alone less developed countries.
Well, when a company develops a high-profile drug like a vaccine, they get a patent on it, they own the rights, they set the price, and they determine who gets discounts and who manufactures it. India and South Africa, as you probably know, have proposed to the World Trade Organization that during the pandemic, all patents be removed, which they say could make it easier to produce and scale up and ultimately make it more affordable. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think that's absolutely the way to go. When we're talking about something like a pandemic, a vaccine is a public good. Everyone needs to be vaccinated. Otherwise, the pandemic will continue. It is having massive effect on, you know, society, trade, economics. It's affecting us in every single way. And we need to make sure that as much vaccine is available at a price that is affordable. And for some countries, that means it has to be donated. And so we have to find mechanisms to do that.
What about just making the vaccine? Is there sufficient manufacturing capacity around the globe to address the need in the most vulnerable countries and everywhere?
Vaccine production for many, many diseases still occurs in a few countries because it requires a lot of investment. However, if all those vaccine production capabilities were able to produce the vaccine and not just the current ones, that would make a difference. But I do want to say that there are other things happening in the world. And so the opportunity cost is very important to consider in this. We have to continue vaccinating for measles. We have to continue vaccinating for diphtheria and whooping cough and polio. So all of these things are continuing to be produced by manufacturers. And so you usurp, in a way, that production capacity by putting another vaccine. So we have to address this in a very logical way that makes sure that all of society benefits and that we don't not vaccinate huge swathes of the population against other diseases that are huge killers.
Dr. Michelle Geyer directs emergency health at the International Rescue Committee. Doctor, thanks so much for discussing this with us.
Thank you.
Vaccines are only part of the story in controlling COVID-19. Testing remains a crucial part of the equation. Just ahead, the promise of rapid testing and how it could help. And later this hour, the pandemic is raising questions about how South Korea cares for people with disabilities.
Not everyone has experience living with someone with a disability. If children with and without disabilities study together in the same classes, then as they grow up, they'll think it's natural to be together.
That story from Seoul, still ahead. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Vaccines on the horizon are bringing new hope, but testing people for infection will remain a critical part of controlling the pandemic. Scientists have made a lot of important advances in testing in the past year. The World's Ilana Gordon has been looking into this. Ilana, when it comes to testing for this coronavirus, what has changed and how widely available are the tests now?
Marco, there's a lot of companies with tests out there now all around the world. It's really up to each country to approve tests for using them. In the U.S., for example, the FDA does this, and so far it's given special emergency approval to several hundred tests. There's basically a quick one and then a slower one. The slower one, it's called PCR, it's more accurate, and that usually gets sent to a lab, whereas the quicker one, an antigen test, it's less sensitive. So there's trade-offs.
Right. So when you say quicker and slower, results coming back more fast and less fast. That's a lot of options. So why in the U.S. can it be so difficult to figure out where and how to get a test?
I asked Dr. Megan Murray about this. She's a professor of epidemiology and global health at Harvard.
I think what it reflects is the lack of oversight of strategy, of who's in charge of distributing tests, who's in charge of coming up with a policy for how they can best be used, and who's in charge of getting them to the places that they need to be. What we've seen is that there's widespread chaos.
So basically, Marco, the U.S. just hasn't put in a solid strategy in place that can ensure equitable, widely available testing.
And what about other countries and other experiences with testing?
She says other countries have done this, especially the ones who've responded early, like in Asia. And then there's other places like Rwanda. They've appeared to have been doing really well in controlling the virus. They don't necessarily have as many resources as the U.S., even for testing, but they do have a very central, clear COVID strategy. And for example, there's quarantine guidelines and support for people who must go into quarantine.
What about other parts of the world? Are tests pretty much available everywhere?
So this is a really big challenge in lots of regions, like in Latin America and Africa. Because for these really accurate tests, you need the lab capacity for it. And many regions don't have those labs, or it can take a while to transport them there. Then there are issues with those fast tests. Early on, there's been problems with like cheap, unlicensed tests being used in places, them being faulty, having to be pulled, or them being misused. But some have become now more reliable. And actually, the World Health Organization recently approved two rapid tests, and they've been partnering with NGOs like the Gates Foundation, the Global Fund, to distribute some 120 million rapid tests to lower-income countries.
So 120 million, I mean, on the one hand, that's a lot, but also it doesn't seem like that much when we consider how many infections are currently around the globe.
Totally. I mean, there's billions of people in the world. This is a fraction. In Africa, a lot of eyes are also on Senegal because the Pasteur Institute there in Dakar, they've been working with a company to come up with a rapid testing kit that's a dollar. And the manufacturing facility just opened this month.
Now, in the U.S., the FDA recently authorized the first at-home rapid COVID test. Can that change the game?
So this at-home rapid test, it's a sensitive test, so that's good. But it does cost about $50 here, and it's going to take months to roll out. Again, Murray with Harvard, the epidemiologist, she says the impact is likely to be limited right now.
If what your goal is to test frequently, say every couple of days, to make sure that you don't have an infection before you, you know, mix with other people, then that's going to quickly add up.
And Marco, just to step back, what Murray has alluded to is this big question and this tension in the U.S., but also across the globe, like in India. Can a cheap, less perfect test be a really useful prevention tool, like you're out in the community? You know, regulatory agencies have been hesitant, but many in public health are really pushing for this approach more and more.
The World's Ilana Gordon, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
You may know the actor in our next story from movies and shows like The Umbrella Academy, Inception, X-Men, and as the lead in the film Juno. The Canadian star who played the pregnant teen in that 2007 film, Elliot Page, came out on Tuesday as transgender. In a letter posted on social media, Page wrote, "I can't begin to express how remarkable it feels to finally love who I am enough to pursue my authentic self." Here's the World's Bianca Hillier.
Support for Page poured in from around the world yesterday. But the 33-year-old has been one of the most visible queer actors in Hollywood for years, after giving this speech at a human rights campaign event in 2014.
And I am here today because I am gay. And because...
That crowd gave Paige a standing ovation. And since then, the Oscar-nominated actor has advocated for LGBTQ rights across the globe.
We're on our next stop around the world, in India.
For a Vice series called Gaycation, Paige crossed continents with his best friend to find out what it's like being queer in places like Tokyo, Ukraine, Jamaica, and Brazil, where in 2016, Paige sat down with then-Congressman Jair Bolsonaro, a vocal critic of the LGBTQ community.
And the things you've said to me come across as very homophobic, and I read a quote that said, someone should beat the gay out of their son. And I'm wondering, I'm gay, so do you think that I should have been beaten as a child to not be gay now?
I'm not going to look at you and say, I think you're gay. That doesn't matter to me. You're very nice. If I were a cadet at the military academy and I saw you on the street, I'd whistle at you, all right? You're very pretty.
Paige continued to stand up for LGBTQ people. Now, after coming out as transgender, he's bringing significant visibility to gender-diverse people, says Aaron DeVore, the chair in transgender studies at the University of Victoria in Paige's native Canada.
It's important for people who are identify as trans or non-binary to see themselves reflected in all aspects of society.
DeVore says the actor's coming out message is also important for straight and cisgender people to pay attention to, as they may think they don't know anyone who's trans or non-binary.
And when it's a celebrity, there is a sense in most people that they do know that person personally. And so it brings it a little closer to home. It makes trans people seem more real, and it builds empathy and understanding.
Understanding was a key theme in Paige's message on Tuesday. He wrote, I want to address the full picture. The statistics are staggering. The discrimination towards trans people is rife, insidious, and cruel, resulting in horrific consequences. Paige noted that at least 40 trans people have been murdered in 2020, the majority of which were Black and Latino women. Paige, a famous white person, knows the privilege he carries. DeVore says he salutes Paige for using his celebrity platform to raise awareness of the injustices so many face.
For a lot of trans people, the kind of life that Elliot Page has is out of reach. And in fact, many trans people, especially trans women of color, their lives are endangered by people knowing that they're trans.
To those people who deal with violence, harassment, and self-loathing every day, Elliot Page wrote, I see you, I love you, and I will do everything I can to change this world for the better. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Dutch climate activists sue a global giant of the oil industry, Royal Dutch Shell, in a bid to force the company to cut its carbon emissions. It would be a big deal if the court rules in favor of environmentalists.
Corporations would have a duty of care to also protect the climate.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. The United Nations says it's reached an agreement with Ethiopia to access the northern region of Tigray. It's been mostly cut off from the outside world recently. Fighting between Ethiopian government forces and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, began a month ago. Hundreds of people are believed to be dead. Tens of thousands are displaced. And people with relatives inside Tigray are still trying to get in touch with their loved ones. The World's Halima Gakandi has more from Addis Ababa.
Here in the Ethiopian capital, the conflict in Tigray feels very far away, but people are following the news. Details about what's happening up north either come from the federal government or the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. Both are difficult to verify. Many Ethiopians I've been speaking with say they support Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and that they're reassured by him claiming victory over the TPLF. But people from the Tigray region say this is a time of real anxiety.
This war should not have happened. It's very sad. These problems, they should have been solved through dialogue.
A young contractor was willing to speak with me, but asked to remain anonymous. She's been hearing rumors that ordinary Tigrayans are being arrested and getting fired from their jobs just because of their ethnicity. In an interview with Reuters on Monday, a government spokesman said that would be inexcusable. Redwan Hussein said the only people being arrested are members of the TPLF suspected of being involved in the conflict.
If you take the military, there are about few, nearly 100. If you take the civilian politicians, nearly 100. So we are simply talking about 200 people against which 200 individuals.
Still, the contractor from Tigray tells me she's afraid. She's originally from the city of Adigrat, a town that's said to be controlled now by the government troops. That's where her family still is, and she says she's worried about her mother.
I don't know whether she's alive or not. We couldn't reach her by phone. Even the phone from the Red Cross isn't working. I've been trying to call her every day, and I still haven't heard anything from my family.
The International Committee of the Red Cross is running a family reunification hotline together with the local Ethiopian Red Cross Society. Red Cross official Andika Mendefro tells me they're using satellite phones to try to connect families separated by the conflict. Communications in Tigray, he says, are still mostly down.
The family from here, from Addis, may just looking for their family members there, and vice versa, by the way.
But the few phone lines that work are often busy, he says. According to the ICRC, more than 3,000 people have reached out in search of loved ones living in Tigray.
We are using almost 5 phones, hotlines. We are getting over the hotline, and families in Addis are coming physically, in person, and they get registered.
Registered so they can get news about how their family members are doing, or if they're lucky, to speak with them directly. But connecting people is a challenge. The numbers of internally displaced people in Tigray is thought to be in the thousands. Mendefru says fear has driven people to IDP camps in towns like Shire, which is said to have been captured by federal forces 2 weeks ago.
When the conflict is happening, people they feel something will happen on their family, on their livelihood, and that is why they just flee and they just sheltered in IDP centers.
A young Tigrayan businessman who often works in Shire spoke with me, but he didn't want to give his name. He told me his girlfriend is still in Tigray, and then he opened his phone to show me his call log. On the night of November 3rd, when the conflict broke out, she tried to call him.
She was calling me around 11 and 20. Until that time, the network is working. Later on, I wake up around 1 after I read something from Telegram and from Facebook. I was calling her, but it's not working.
He says he regrets missing her call that night because he hasn't heard from her since, and he has no idea how she's doing.
I don't know where she is now. I don't have information. I don't know whether she's going to Sudan or whether going to Mekelle. I don't have any information, actually. I can't get. You know, even my family also.
More than 40,000 people from Tigray have fled to neighboring Sudan since the conflict broke out. The businessman says he's been getting sporadic calls from friends who've gone there, people who had to leave everything behind.
They are really in bad situation. They leave all their homes. They damage all their homes in Humara. They leave all their cars. Even they have also camel, ox and something. They leave everything. Even the friends of my brother, his daughter and his son is died on the way, and they go only with his wife.
But so far, he tells me, he still heard nothing about his own family. Today, Ethiopia's government-owned telecoms company announced communications were opening back up in parts of Tigray. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Addis Ababa.
Diplomats get into it sometimes. In other words, on occasion, they can be pretty undiplomatic. That's exactly what appears to have happened in a recent NATO meeting. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo reportedly accused Turkey of cozying up to Russia, while Turkey's foreign minister pointed the finger at Pompeo for ganging up on the Turks. To talk through what this diplomatic kerfuffle was all about, we turn to Stephen Cook. Cook is a senior fellow for Middle East and Africa at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also an expert on Turkish politics. Stephen, this was a meeting with Pompeo and foreign ministers from U.S. allies in NATO. What were they meeting to talk about?
Well, this was a routine NATO ministerial to discuss issues before the alliance. It also comes at a time when a major report that was commissioned by the French to chart the way forward for NATO over the course of the next decade or more. But it was notable that Pompeo really went after the Turks. This was Pompeo's last NATO ministerial. So he clearly took the opportunity to take some parting shots at Ankara.
Right. So if this is probably Pompeo's last big meeting as Trump's Secretary of State, what do you think he was trying to accomplish by confronting Turkey?
Well, first of all, Turkey has been pursuing a foreign policy that runs contrary to NATO. It is not an exaggeration to suggest that the Turks have cozied up to the Russians. They've bought a major air defense system from the Russians. They've worked with the Russians in places like Syria and Nagorno-Karabakh. They've also pursued a rather aggressive posture in the Eastern Mediterranean that has threatened NATO allies like Greece. So he's not entirely wrong on that issue. But we also have to keep in mind that Secretary Pompeo does have political ambitions.
So you mentioned that new NATO report. What will the next 10 years of NATO look like? And what is Turkey's role?
Turkey will remain within the alliance so long as the Turks want to remain. Every now and again, bubbles up that Turkey should be thrown out of NATO. But there's no mechanism to remove an alliance member. They have to decide to leave the alliance. But there are serious questions about the unity of NATO and what its purpose is going forward. There are all kinds of questions. And then, of course, there are these tensions within the alliance. The United States has obviously been the leader of this alliance. And over the course of the last 4 years, President Trump really has not undertaken the care and feeding of the alliance and given it much direction.
So NATO is at best at a turning point, at worst, unstable. What does the future of NATO look like with the new Biden administration?
Well, it's clear from President-elect Biden's statements that he sees America being back and that he wants to reestablish America's traditional role as the leader of the alliance and inject some life into it. You have to give President Trump some credit. The pressure that he's put on NATO allies has led to an increase in their defense spending. But at the same time, his attacks on the alliance have weakened it, just as we see a resurgent Russia. So it seems that President Biden will want to rejuvenate the alliance and direct it towards the efforts on the part of the Russians to weaken Europe, weaken the alliance, sow questions within the alliance about Western unity, and undertake aggressive actions on the alliance's periphery, whether it be Syria or in North Africa.
And Stephen, given that Mike Pompeo seemed to further muddy the waters with Turkey at this NATO meeting, what does a confrontation like this one at the meeting do to the incoming Biden administration? Like, how will Turkey and Recep Tayyip Erdogan view the new White House with this as a Trump parting shot?
There is a debate in Washington, a rather robust debate about what to do about Turkey. I think everybody recognizes that Turkey's foreign policy, particularly over the course of the last few years, has been problematic for the United States. It has complicated the fight against the Islamic State. It has increased tensions in the Eastern Mediterranean. There's tensions between Turkey and other strategic partners of the United States, including Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. So Turkey is a real problem, and there is a debate over whether to punish Turkey for this aggressive action or whether to do things to try to salvage and save the relationship and set it on a new path. That is going to occupy some time of Biden's national security team. President-elect Biden is not known to have the kind of warm personal relationship with President Erdogan that President Trump did or that President Obama did in his first few years in office. So certainly Turkey is going to be one of those foreign policy challenges for the new administration.
Stephen Cook, Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa, the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
There are 1 billion people around the world living with a disability, and COVID-19 has impacted them disproportionately. South Korea's first coronavirus death back in February took place in the psychiatric unit of a hospital. That revived a longstanding call in Korea for people with disabilities to be moved out of institutions and placed in community care. Jason Strother has that story from Seoul.
Chu Kyungjin lives in a 1-bedroom apartment on the 4th floor in a high-rise. His full-time caregiver lets me and Minjin, my interpreter, inside. Chu hasn't gotten out much this year because of the pandemic. He says he doesn't want to take any chances. Minjin and I are sure to keep our masks on, The windows open too for ventilation. Chu, who is 51, is unable to move his legs and arms. He uses a wheelchair to get around. For much of the past two decades, he lived with hundreds of other people with disabilities in a sprawling residential care center. Even though he feels a little isolated now, Chu says he's much better off here than back there. In a place like there, Chu says, there's no way to protect yourself from diseases like the coronavirus. When he heard about the COVID-19 deaths at a local psychiatric ward earlier this year, Chu says all he could think about was how easily that could have been him. That is, if he had never gotten out. In 1997, a motorbike accident paralyzed Chu from his neck down. He says his disability strained his marriage. He recalls telling his wife, in frustration, "Just put me in a home." I never thought she'd actually do it, he tells me. One night, she just left me in front of a care center. He didn't hear from her or see his two children for the next 5 years. The couple is divorced now. Chu says he thought he would spend the rest of his life in an institution where he had no control over daily tasks like when to wake up or what to eat. But he was determined to live on his own. In 2016, Chu was finally discharged thanks in part to new disability rights laws. Now he's an advocate for Koreans with disabilities. These institutions need to be closed, he says. People with and without disabilities should live together in the community. The South Korean government says around 25,000 people with a disability currently live in long-term care homes, but unlike Chu, most are unable to advocate for their release. That's according to Saul Wonsun at the Korea Disabled People's Development Institute. He says most institutionalized people have a developmental impairment and cannot make that decision for themselves. They need a relative or guardian to sign off. But some, Saul says, are completely cut off from their families.
Sometimes when they have a severe, like intellectual disability or severe autistic disability, intentionally family members send them to the large institution and they change addresses, they change telephone number.
So they can never be found?
Right. That is a tragic history of the disability.
For some people with disabilities, just filling out the paperwork needed to get out of a care facility is a barrier. Byun Jae-won helps people in that situation. He's with a group called Solidarity Against Disability Discrimination. It offers job training and education. Byun says disabled people are often told they'll never survive outside the institution. That's why some families put loved ones in institutions in the first place.
In South Korea, it's very competitive. So the family who have the child with disability or who have the member with disability, they feel burdened.
Financially, but also socially, Byun says there's still a stigma about disability in Korea, and some parents feel embarrassed by children with disabilities, like his own.
In my case, my mother always said me that you are so ashamed in our family.
Byun is 27 and walks with crutches. He was never institutionalized, but he suspects that his mother might have preferred that. He recalls her saying things like,
"I want that you just stay at home, invisible."
The Korean government wants to help people with disabilities become more visible. It increased support for independent living, and last year it launched a program that integrates private housing with medical services. But some say these steps don't go far enough to make Korea fully inclusive. Jang Hae-young is a lawmaker in the National Assembly. She also produced a documentary about taking her sister out of institutional care.
Not everyone has experience living with someone with a disability. If children with and without disabilities study together in the same classes, then as they grow up, they'll think it's natural to be together.
Jung says school integration could help reduce prejudice. And that's what prevents many people with disabilities from eventually getting jobs. I met some parents of children with developmental impairments who say they worry a lot about their kids' future. So last year, they created jobs for their kids. Baek Jae-uk is working the espresso machine behind the counter of the Jayundo Cafe in the city of Incheon. The 15-year-old is one of five teens with an autism spectrum disorder who've earned barista certificates here. Baek shows me his degree, but he's a little too shy to answer questions. Baek's mother is Hong Ju-yun. She and the other families opened the cafe not just for job training. It's so their kids can improve their social skills by talking with strangers. And then members of the public get to know people with autism. Hong says the shop might help some parents overcome their own prejudice toward disability. I'm not embarrassed by my son, Hong says, and I tell other parents of kids with autism that they shouldn't feel ashamed about their child's disability. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
Jason's reporting was supported by the National Geographic Society's Emergency Fund for Journalists. Royal Dutch Shell, not just one of the globe's biggest energy companies, one of the biggest companies in the world, full stop. And now a group of environmental organizations is suing Royal Dutch Shell. They want the company to take a stronger stance against climate change, specifically to rein the company's carbon emissions in by 45% within a decade. Joanna Setzer at the London School of Economics has authored reports on climate litigation around the globe and joins us now. Joanna, who is behind the lawsuit against Royal Dutch Shell and what is their case?
This is an interesting case brought in the Netherlands by Friends of the Earth Netherlands and seven other organizations, together with 17,000 Dutch citizens who are co-plaintiffs.
Which way could this case go? I mean, what are the possible verdicts?
This is a case that is very much inspired in a previous landmark case that was successful in the exact same court of The Hague in the Netherlands. In that case, the plaintiffs were asking the government to step up their ambition. This case is adapted to a case against corporations. They want the commitments made by the company to be consistent to global commitments such as the Paris Agreement. So if they win, not only the case will be sending a strong message to oil companies and energy companies, but also to a wider set of actors in the corporate world that not only can commit in words, but they also have to commit in practice.
And Joanna, what happened to that other case at The Hague, and what lessons should these plaintiffs draw from it in their lawsuit against Royal Dutch Shell?
What happened was that for the first time, a court told a government to do more. The understanding there was that protecting the climate and having more ambitious targets is a matter of human rights. So the government had a duty of care to protect the citizens of the Netherlands and indeed of the world. What happens if we transfer this same idea into the case against corporations is that corporations would have a duty of care to also protect the climate. So it is really a big message and one that we will soon hear is likely to influence a number of other cases and corporate behavior.
A lawyer for Royal Dutch Shell made the point that Shell is working hard on energy transition. They're developing a huge wind energy project in the Netherlands. They're working on green hydrogen projects. And the point he also made on behalf of the company is that, quote, no single private party can change the energy system on its own, not even Shell. Doesn't he have a point? And how would the court take on that argument?
Well, he does have a point. Indeed, addressing climate change is not something that one single court will be able to do by itself. It's not something that one company can do. What is happening here with these lawsuits is that they are showing who are the main actors that have to make a difference, who have to change behavior. And these are governments and the major emitters. But that's not the end of the story. Of course, many others will have to change, and it's still very much a government, a policy issue. And it's not to say that this case is throwing all the responsibility, all the liability in one single company. These cases are strategic. They come with a message. They have a strategy behind them to point out, to single out a few of these actors, but they are far from being the only alternative and solution to the problem.
Well, to your point, also this week, the European Court of Human Rights has ordered 33 European countries to respond to a landmark climate lawsuit filed by six Portuguese teenagers. They're saying that governments are moving too slowly to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Who are those teenagers? What governments are they pointing the finger at? And do you think they can win in the courts?
So this is another very interesting case. A group of Portuguese children who are arguing that governments in 33 European countries have not done enough to prevent the impacts of climate change from violating their citizens' human rights. This week, we had the court announcing that it will take the case to the next step, to the defendant countries, so they can respond to the arguments. We were saying it's not enough one state, one company. This case tries to bring many more, so 33 European states together in a lawsuit that aims to have these states reducing their greenhouse gas emissions.
So we're talking about two climate action lawsuits that seem to have some energy behind them. But we should point out that last year, a Berlin court threw out a lawsuit by three farming families in Germany. They said the government of Angela Merkel wasn't doing enough to tackle climate change. Why was that thrown out of court?
Well, most cases, to be honest, have not been successful. A few cases that have been successful, there are hundreds that haven't been successful. And also there are hundreds of cases that are ongoing. For example, there is a case that was not successful in Switzerland, a case brought by a group of senior Swiss women. In May this year, May 2020, the Supreme Federal Court of Switzerland denied the case. And just this week, this group of women were then able to file another complaint, now the second one, to the European Court of Human Rights. What's different about the second one is that they can say that they have exhausted all the national remedies and therefore they're going to the European Court of Human Rights. With regards to the German case that you mentioned, it's another possibility that if they lose domestically, they can still try to file a complaint internationally, or indeed other cases can be filed. What I think this all shows is that it's really a gate that has been opened and there are new strategies, new approaches that are being tried. And if one loses, not necessarily that will mean that it's closing the door. The litigants have been very creative and they are filing cases against governments, against corporations on many different bases, trying different remedies. So the possibilities are many.
The ones that were successful, on balance, what have they accomplished?
Well, that's a good question, because even if you get to victory in court, it doesn't mean that everything will change immediately. For example, there has been a successful case in Pakistan where the state was also told to basically implement the adaptation measures that were needed to protect vulnerable people in Pakistan. And the implementation hasn't been as immediate or as effective maybe as you would want to see. Similarly, a case in Colombia, in that case, despite a Supreme Court saying that the government had to reduce deforestation, the levels of deforestation continued to increase. So unfortunately, not necessarily having a decision in court will immediately translate into the change in policies that those lawsuits are trying to get.
Joanna Setzer is a specialist in climate litigation and an assistant professor on the environment at the London School of Economics. Joanna, thank you for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
There's a lot that goes on behind the mic to bring the show to you every day. Trust me, there is a hardworking team producing the world. We also like to have fun. So if you have a moment, find out more about us. Just head to theworld.org/whoweare. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, be healthy, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. From PR.